Hello and welcome to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience, also faculty affiliate in law and public affairs, and also the Princeton Election Consortium.
So after a year with a very little momentum on legislation, last year around Christmas time, President Trump ended the year with a pretty big bang with the corporate tax cut that packs a wallop and appears to give pretty sizable tax break to many corporations. The tax package had been anticipated all year long. It came later than many thought, but it certainly energized Republicans at the end of the year, both because it was a legislative victory and in some ways it fulfilled the kind of promises the party has been making at least since the 1980s. And it also raises the question, of course, about the power of corporations in Washington through lobbying and campaign finance and through the political mobilization the business world has undertaken now for decades. Gordon Lafer is a political economist, associate professor at the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center, and he's going to be here with us today to discuss both the cut and also what it means about politics. He's a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute as well. He's written on many issues involving labor and employment policy. He wrote a book called The Job Training Charade, and more recently he wrote a new book called The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time, which came out recently with Cornell University Press. He's also the co-chair of the American Political Science Association's Labor Project. He was an analyst for the Office of the Mayor of New York City. He also worked in the Senate and House and in state politics. He's done lots and lots and lots of stuff, including senior labor policy advisor to the Committee on Education, Labor, and the House. So we're really delighted to have him on the show. Gordon, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Maybe we can just start with the basics. If you can just open up with telling us what does this tax package that just passed through Congress, what are some of the big ticket items that it's going to accomplish?
Well, I think there's a few things that are significant about it. I mean, obviously, it's a very big tax cut that is very heavily slanted towards not corporations and the rich, and actually more corporations even than wealthy individuals. And most of the discussion in the lead up to that was about who's going to benefit from it and how, you know, which segments of society are going to benefit more or less. But it's also, you know, it's close to $1 trillion. It's also going to end up, I think, meaning a lot of cuts to public services down the road when the government figures out how to pay for this, and also when, as we're already seeing now in attempts to pass a continuing budget resolution or a new budget in the Congress, new calls for, after having created and exacerbating the deficit by this new tax cut, now new calls from the Republican Party to make cuts to public services in order to pay for that deficit. So I think it's both, you know, increasing the inequality in the country, which has already been obviously growing over a number of decades, and going to end up in cutting public services.
And if you were going back to the Supreme Court Citizen United decision, which now was many years ago, and there were many predictions that this would influence public policy and accelerate a shift toward policies that support rather than diminish inequality, is it fair to say that decision had an impact and that there is a line you could draw between that decision, which took place when Obama was president, and this tax package, which just passed when President Trump was in office?
I think so. I mean, you know, it's, as I'm sure all your listeners know, I mean, politics is not like people imagine science, where you can do controlled experiments and line up exactly what causes what by how much. But, you know, what Citizens United, which was January of 2010, was that decision, essentially said what it essentially made possible is that the growing economic inequality in the country could be translated into growing political inequality. And, you know, it was already the case long before Citizens United that wealthy people and corporations had a far disproportionate influence in politics, but that became much more extreme after Citizens United. There has been some actual statistical research done on state elections that show the impact of that on state elections, which is significant. It's harder to trace in any given bill that makes its way through Congress. But I think that there's no question that this represents the the triumph of the interests of wealthy corporations in the country. And one of the ways that you see that is so striking is that this is not what President Trump's base was calling for. This was the big triumph of the, billed as the big triumph of the Republican Party. But I think what it really was is that the big corporate lobbies pretty much unanimously were opposed to Trump. They backed almost any of the other candidates. None of them backed Trump in the Republican primaries. And for them, it's been kind of playing with fire of a calculation of, keeping the conservative base energized around issues that they thought were dangerous and were losers in national politics that are social conservative issues. And they were kind of waiting to see, can we get enough of what we want out of this? And I think it was very telling that of all the different things that could have been the kind of make or break issues for the Republicans in Congress, it was this one. And it was this one because, and some members of Congress said this very openly, that their donors were saying, if you can't get this done, we're going to stop putting money into you. So this was really strikingly a triumph of the donor class of the Republican Party. And I think both parties have tension between their donor class and their base. But this was not the triumph of the white working class or the people who've been talked about a lot as making the difference and being newly energized by Trump's candidacy. So it's striking that way, too, right? It's a triumph mostly not of the White House, but of the Congress, where people are very heavily in debt to these corporate donors.
Well, let me just interject this. I realize that there are some things that are hard to prove through research, but just to fill in some of that from, I believe, text from your own book, you point out generation of mega donors. More than 60% of all personal campaign contributions in 2012 came from less than 0.5% of the population. And then there's this organization, which I'm hoping we'll talk about in a moment, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which, I think we want to give our listeners a little tutorial on that, because I think that the chain of causation, no matter how hard it might be or how challenging it might be to study at an academic level, the chain of causation is actually pretty clear.
Well, I'm very happy to talk about ALEC. This is the single most important organization at the level of state legislatures through which we can see how corporations act politically. And I think it's important, for several reasons. This is an organization that was very secretive until 2010 when there was a whistleblower who dumped thousands of documents into the public domain. So we can see things that normally people just kind of guess at or theorize about. The way ALEC works is about one quarter of all state legislators in America are members. They pay just $50 a year in dues, and the rest of the expenses are paid by several hundred of the biggest, most well-known corporations in the country, and Coke and Pepsi and Ford and GM and Google and UPS. I mean, lots and lots of companies. And for listeners who are interested, there is a website that lists all of this called ALEC Exposed, ALECExposed.org.
I'm on it now. It is a very informative site. I'm on it right this minute.
Yeah. So those companies pay the expenses. They meet four times a year in committees that are made up half of elected legislators and half of corporate lobbyists. And they write bills together. And then those bills are introduced in cookie cutter fashion in state after state around the country.
And 2,000 state legislators, according to you, are members of ALEC, right?
That's right. And the ALEC estimates that it introduces 1,000 bills a year and passes 200. And, there's been a lot of work tracking these. For people involved in academia, might be interested to know some of the research was done using the same anti-plagiarism software that faculty get given to make sure that students' papers don't come from somewhere else, and found, the bill saying we the people of Arizona were the same as we the people of Tennessee. But you can really see the pattern of identical bills being introduced. And then the same companies that write the laws then fund these candidates' campaigns, fund their own independent expenditures on politics, on print, broadcast, and digital media, and fund state-level think tanks to promote their desired policies. So it's a very well-funded, very, very well-coordinated 50-state campaign to rewrite the rules that govern the economy. And if I could explain a little of what they do, some things are the things you might guess at, which is laws to increase the profits of specific member companies. So like Coke and Pepsi were active, and ALEC lobbied against restrictions on sugary soft drinks. There are tech companies active, and they lobbied to block cities from providing free broadband internet. The pharmaceutical industry is in ALEC, and they block importing cheap drugs from Canada. There is payday loan companies are members of ALEC. And they blocked an attempt, this was in Florida, to limit the interest on payday loans to 36%. So that kind of stuff is, maybe unseemly and is certainly problematic, but it's not surprising. But they also lobby for a lot of things that look more like class interest, that rather than being related to the specific bottom line of a member company. And that includes tax cuts, cutting minimum wage, cutting unemployment insurance, defunding public services, everything from libraries to K-12 education, higher education, public transit.
Yeah.
So, and all of these things, and people can don't have to trust me. You can find it on that website, see all of their model bills. When we need to look at this and understand this is not some ideological billionaire individual. Every one of these companies at some point had a meeting of something, government affairs committee or executive committee, and decided it made sense to put time, money, and energy into promoting this ALEC agenda. So I think we need to take that seriously. These are the most powerful actors in American politics, and their agenda is now pretty clear because we've had these whistleblower documents and we've had a number of years across all 50 states to watch what they're doing.
So basically, this sounds like the big libertarian agenda, which is to make government look weak, to create a situation in which government doesn't do a good job of helping people, that to undermine that program. And so it's this pretty big picture agenda that seems to be pursued here by ALEC.
I think it is big picture, but I think it goes a little too far to call it libertarian, only in the sense, people debate how much do people act based on ideology versus something else. But again, these are corporations. These are not individuals. So these people, they're required by law to act in what they believe to be the best interests of their shareholders. And there are many, many points where you can find contradictions between how they act on one bill or another, and certainly contradictions between libertarian principles and how they act, even among the Koch brothers, who are the most, supposedly the most ideological and the most libertarian of political actors. The most striking thing was on the TARP bank bailout in 2009, which runs against all of their libertarian principles and which they were all against until the stock market crashed and they were afraid that they were personally and their corporation was about to lose a lot of money. And they flipped 180 degrees and became TARP supporters.
So pro-corporate rather than pro-corporate as opposed to, say, just anti-government.
Right. And then the question becomes, like, why do corporations think this set of policies is in their self-interest? And that, I feel like, is the right and clearer way to at least start the conversation and thinking about this.
Well, in your book, in The 1% Solution, you open with an anecdote about that dates to 2015, Tennessee's Republican Governor Bill Haslam. Maybe tell us a little bit about, because that story seems to reveal some of these principles, some of these ideas a little bit. So maybe tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was an effort by the Republican governor of Tennessee and the Republican state legislature in Tennessee to expand state Medicaid to cover, I think it was 200,000 more people in Tennessee. And they had wall-to-wall Republican control. The governor had been reelected with 70% of the vote. They had done internal polling by Republican pollsters who found this to be popular. They'd worked very hard to differentiate it from Obamacare and say this is not Obamacare, and they negotiated with the Obama White House to get conservative exceptions to how this would work. And then it still got killed, and it got killed because of Americans for Prosperity, which is the Koch brothers' organization for state politics that spent a lot of money on advertisement and also on field organizers. And so I think this points to a couple things. One is, why do the Koch brothers, who are oil industry people, care about Medicaid enough to put money into trying to defeat something? Two, the traditional view that corporations are kind of cheerleaders for the Republican Party, or that you'd think of them as a subset of the Republican Party, and here it's the other way around, right, which I think it gets revealed that they have their own interests, and Republican politicians may or may not be useful, but they're not just a part of that partisan agenda. And the third and kind of most striking thing is that the power of these corporate groups is now bigger than the political parties, right? We have unified Republican control of a state, very popular, at the height of their power, and they get beat by an outside corporate organization.
Well, one thing I noticed, I was once about a year ago in the first few months of 2017, I was at a gathering of CEOs. There were some academics, there was mostly CEOs, and it was right after the election of Donald Trump. And the thing that really struck me there was some discussion about liberal priorities, conservative priorities, civil rights, individual rights. But one thing that was just this overwhelming feeling in the room at that time was that very much on those CEOs' minds was a large corporate tax cut. And this surprised me because it was just not what was in the public conversation. It wasn't something that was floating around in the news. The news was filled with stuff like the immigration ban. But in the meantime, the overwhelming feeling in that room was that they were very focused on that. And it was just fascinating. It was just like dogs with a treat in front of them. And they were all fixated on the treat. And they wanted that treat. And the treat was this big tax cut. And it was the first I had heard about it. And so it was to my thinking, telling that that was a thing that they knew about, they were thinking about, and then what? Like about 9 or 10 months later, you know, the one piece of productive legislation out of the current Congress is something that cuts corporate taxes by effectively more than half.
Right. And so I think, you know, we're in a time where it's very easy to get sucked into being, you know, having our attention glued to the circus of the White House. And, you know, if you're a critic of Trump, this outrage and that outrage, I guess if you're a fan, this heroic declaration and that heroic declaration. But then if you look behind it and say, like, what's actually happening and what's actually driving what happens, it's primarily the corporate agenda that's getting enacted. I mean, the tax cut is the big legislative move, but if you look at what's happening in regulation, certainly in environmental protection, in labor, in other areas, it's not the big social conservative move. It's not big anti-immigrant moves. It's the corporate agenda that is being enacted, which speaks to the power of that, even when the election on the right was not an election about corporate priorities. I mean, Trump ran far to the right of the corporate lobbies on social issues and rhetorically, at least, far to the left on economic issues. But that's not what's happening.
So this conversation we could have about certainly during many points in American history. You know, there's a huge body of historians who write about turn of the 20th century and how corporations shaped a lot of public policy. But more recently, obviously, you know, the election of Ronald Reagan and the conservative movement, the triumph of supply side economics was very important, and deregulation. And then with George W. Bush, one of the first things he does is a sizable tax cut. Is there a difference in what we're seeing right now in terms of what corporations are looking for and what they're able to achieve than, say, the 1980s? Or is this just a continuation of that trend?
I do think it's different. I mean, obviously, as you said, you know, everybody wants more money. Corporations have been, you know, we're opposed to the minimum wage and Social Security, and a lot of academics have written very good work about those fights at different times. But I think the playing field is different now, and also the kind of the political problems. I mean, in two ways. One is, as the economy has gotten more unequal, political power has also gotten more unequal, obviously, especially exacerbated by Citizens United. We also have a difference in corporate interests, which I think come primarily from two things. One is the degree of globalization, and the other is the degree of financialization. And just to be, you know, very brief about it, it was 1953 when the president of GM suggested to the U.S. Senate that what's good for GM is good for America. And I'm not sure that was ever exactly true, but it was closer to true when GM cars were made by American workers and bought by American consumers. So just to take GM now, most of their, I think two-thirds of their cars are sold overseas, and most of their employees are overseas. So we're in an odd situation where it's illegal for foreign corporations to spend money on American political campaigns, but legally American-based corporations, even if 80% of their revenue were overseas, can spend unlimited amounts of money in American politics. So for the first time, we have very significant players in American politics whose interests are increasingly divergent from American society. Now, the United States is still a big country and a big market, and it matters. But it matters less than it ever has before in terms of that. And then, you know, financialization, which also is a process that took many decades with a lot of legislative and regulatory action, but that essentially created a situation where major corporations that are not financial corporations are operating on very short-term time horizons of really just being concerned with quarterly stock price reports and putting most of their earnings back into trying to prop up the share price through share buybacks or dividends, which changes the calculation of the decision makers in big corporations. There was a little clip during the presidential election that Hillary Clinton called, I think, the one-quarter economy, and she told the story about talking to a CEO who she was friendly with and saying, you know, wouldn't it be in your long-term interest to pay a little more in taxes if we could improve the infrastructure, the roads, the bridges, the water, the electricity? And the guy said, yeah, it would, and probably 15 years from now, that would help the earnings of our company, but in a year, I would be out of a job because I wouldn't have boosted the share price. And so it may be short-sighted for the company, but is rational for the person making that decision. I think those things are different than in the past. And then I think, I'll try not to talk too much, but I think the other thing that is different is that we're kind of at the end of the period of of what you could call neoliberal economic policy that roughly started in the around 1980, really across the world. And you know, what we're seeing here is what we're seeing in many other countries, both the rise of somewhat more extreme left or more progressive left policies, both Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, the Greek government, and then a kind of right-wing populism that is more extreme than we've seen in many different countries. And we need to look at this, and it's like, you know, if you see the same thing happening in 12 different countries, you can't have an explanation that is only about America. I think we're at a point where economic life has gotten so hard for most people, especially for people who are not college-educated professionals, that it creates a lot of anxiety, a lot of resentment, a lot of rage, and that can cut either left or right, as we saw in the last election. And it makes politics more combustible and more unstable and harder for politicians to win who are moderates of one kind or another.
But the way you're describing that, it starts to make sense why these corporate interests would be aligned with forces on the far right, like, you know, anti-immigrant forces and you know, this white anger in Rust Belt parts of the United States. Because if, on one hand, this agenda is stuff like corporate taxes, privatization of public services, deregulation of business, on the other side of it are forces on the left, which are populist forces, where people want jobs, people want government benefits. And so if you're part of this corporate agenda, you need people who are going to help with your side. And it's not quite so much that they are racist. It's not quite that they are anti-immigrant. It's just that, you know what, if they reach for a tool in a democratic society where people vote, they reach for the handiest tool that they can, that is at least not aligned against their interests, where the left, or neoliberals as you put it, that side maybe wants government services and a well-functioning government. And they say, well, who's against that? Well, it's these people who are mad about losing manufacturing jobs. It's these people who are mad about immigrants. And so now there's a couple of things here. One is that sort of explains the alliance. Second, it feels like it can help us make predictions about the future. And I'm very much into making predictions about the future, because it's one thing to, like, you know, have a bunch of hot gas about, like, what's causing things, even if it's likely true, you have a plausible story. But now we can make a prediction. What's going to fall by the wayside? Well, evidently the corporate tax cut was important. Another prediction would be keeping out immigrants might fall by the wayside because it doesn't seem aligned with the story that you're telling.
Well, the corporate lobbies have always been for keeping immigrants here, and they're you know, open to various ways to do that if you legalize people and call them guest workers, but essentially want low-wage people who are also exploitable in the sense that they don't have citizenship rights to protest their conditions, they can't organize unions or vote or write a letter to the editor, and they'll be afraid to protest.
So intermediate is good. Like, this sort of suspended in-between status is actually optimal for corporate interests as opposed to path to citizenship.
Right. Getting rid of immigrants has always been right, something that corporations oppose.
Keep them around,
but,
keep
you know,
them down.
To go back to, you know, what you were talking about, the relationship between the donor class and the base on the right, I mean, they have an obvious problem, right? For the corporate lobbies, the problem is, how do you pursue an agenda that is going to make things yet more unequal and make life materially harder for the majority of people and not provoke a backlash? So for 30 years or so, the formula on the right was that the corporate lobbies got their tax cuts or whatever they wanted, and the base was organized around anti-marriage equality, anti-abortion, and anti-immigrant stuff. And around 2010, 2012, the corporate lobbies, as well as the mainstream GOP, concludes that this is deadly in federal campaigns. I mean, issues like, obviously, marriage equality flipped very quickly, very strongly, and they said, we can't run on these things anymore. So the Tea Party, which was many different things for different people, for the corporate backers, for the Koch brothers and people like that, the Tea Party was an experiment in trying to create a conservative base that was galvanized only around the issues of anti-tax and anti-government and got rid of all the social conservative issues. And it kind of worked for a couple of years, and then it fizzled out, and then Trump blew it up. And Trump comes along and says, no, how we're going to organize the base is around this more radical social agenda. And I think all the corporate lobbies were nervous about that. And I, you know, when you talk about predicting the future, I'm my PhD is in political science, and so we're a field that failed to predict the downfall of the Soviet Union and other very big things. So I'm a little reticent about predictions, but
there are falsifiable statements that could be made about, you know, what's likely to happen if your interpretation is true. So let's do it.
Okay.
I'll stay out of this one.
To start with this, I think the most dangerous thing is that President Trump ran for election above all on the promise to make life better for people without college degrees, to create decently paying jobs for people without college degrees, which is two-thirds of America. And he's not doing that. Assuming he continues to not do that, maybe at some point, that I don't know when it is because people will give him the benefit of the doubt for a while, as that becomes clear, I think the only place for him to move is to whip up a yet more intense white nationalist frenzy. And that's a dangerous point. So I would think those things that people see as dangerous are going to become more dangerous in the future if progressives don't figure out a political program that can win back the loyalty of some of the people who voted for Trump for understandable reasons out of fear of their economic situation.
So basically this rift in the Republican Party.
Can I just jump in? How do you distinguish? And this is a question when a lot of people have raised this, but when there are discussions of the Koch brothers or when there are discussions about the rising influence of corporations, how do you distinguish that from a broader kind of conservatism about government that might exist without that? And, you know, I know polls show the public supports government programs broadly. But still, the vote for President Trump was in many ways just the traditional Republican coalition with a few others thrown in. And so how much is the corporate mobilization you really show very well influencing this? And how do you weigh that relative to something bigger that just fits with what corporations want anyway?
Well, first of all, I think when we look at actual corporations as decision makers, as I said, I don't think they're motivated by ideology. There are many, you know, places where you can see in the corporate agenda that runs at times runs against traditional conservative things, whether that's fiscal conservatism or even shrinking government programs. Some they want to shrink and some they don't. And I think that it's less influential about, I mean, there's a question of influencing what people think.
Yeah.
And then there's influencing what laws get passed. Mm-hmm. And obviously, there's a big gap between what people think. I think Marty Gillens at Princeton did some of the most important work on that, right? And then what laws get passed. Because obviously, people get elected and are indebted to the people who are going to get them reelected, which increasingly is money and not kind of mass popular movement. So I think certainly at the state level, when you look at what laws get passed, which is a much richer place for analysis than the federal government, if only because so many more laws get passed in state legislatures. We see that, like, you know, not there's nobody who wins all the time. There's no single conspiracy or something, but overwhelmingly, these are the laws that get passed. And they're very often laws that are not popular, or like the tax cut just that nobody was thinking about, was not the popular agenda, is not what politicians campaigned on in the election season, but is what they do in office.
Yeah, so I mean, that makes a lot of sense, and I think there's a lot of support for that. And then it raises the next question for the skeptic of kind of clearly what explains the losses. I mean, that seems to be as important as the victories. But at the state level and certainly at the federal level, the corporations don't always win out. And they don't do that with their candidate. They don't always do that with policy. So how do we look at the failures of corporations and this corporate mobilization and understand what kind of what accounts for one versus the other? Maybe it's not predictable, but are there certain areas where they can't get what they want?
I think it remains to be seen. There are certainly places where they've lost. The places where it's hardest for them and most fertile for progressive forces is when there's an opportunity for people to vote on specific issues as opposed to for candidates. Mm-hmm. You know, on an issue-by-issue basis, the corporate agenda is very unpopular and generally is bipartisanly unpopular. I mean, a majority of both Republicans and Democrats support a big increase in the minimum wage, support that everybody should have the right to paid sick leave, support smaller classes in schools, you know, a lot of things like that. But people vote for candidates for all kinds of reasons and not necessarily those issues. So you see this in states and cities where there is a right to have a ballot initiative, which laws vary from state to state, that we see things like minimum wage increases or even in 2016, Arizona, for instance, voted for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton by a significant margin, and by a bigger margin voted to raise the state's minimum wage and create a right to paid sick leave for everybody. And when you do the math, there had to be at least a couple hundred thousand people who both voted for Trump and voted for those things. So when there's an opportunity to organize politically around issues rather than around parties or individuals, that's harder for the corporate lobbies, and it's better for people trying to make things more progressive. I think that when we look at local, state, and federal politics, corporate power is clearly at its height at the level of state legislatures, mm-hmm. and one of the reasons is almost nobody's paying attention. Less than a quarter of adult Americans can name who their state representative is, and less than half even know which party is the majority party, which means the, you know, what is normally thought of as the most crude form of political accountability, which is when times are bad, you vote against the party in power, even that doesn't function at the state level. And because so few people are paying attention, it means the power of moneyed interests is all the more powerful, because not only because elections are cheap, but because very few state-level politicians have name recognition or a real organized base that could be a counterweight to the power of money.
So the decline of the local media would be an important part of the story. We've seen this as a big trend in the last few decades, and state coverage is just diminishing. And so in terms of this gap that you're talking about, that would seem to be a pretty essential development that allows corporations probably to have more sway than they might if there was a little sunshine thrown on what's going on in the state capitals.
I think that's right. I think the number of state house reporters is down by 40% over the last decade. And so this also means, you know, as you would suspect, that some issues which a lot of people know about and require almost no explanation, like the minimum wage, is a lot harder for the corporate lobbies to win on. But the more technical something is, the more it becomes kind of insider legislative things and is not well known, the more likely they are to
win. Plenty of the machinery of government is, you know, my favorite topic, gerrymandering, which I've talked about repeatedly on this program. Plenty of this machinery is vitally important and yet somewhat obscure. I mean, even nomination of judges, like it's hard for a lot of people to get worked up about those kinds of things. I just wanted to interject here that that this business about states with initiatives or referendums, this is getting into the weeds just slightly. I'm over at ballotpedia.org looking at this, and there seem to be 26 states that allow an initiative or a referendum process, and mostly they're west of the Mississippi. And so oddly, you know, for whatever reason, there's a few states east of the Mississippi, Michigan, Ohio, Maryland, that have a clean shot where voters can get at the ballot with an issue. And then west of the Mississippi is really kind of a festival of the ability for voters to have their voice heard. And so it feels like different solutions have different states require different solutions, where maybe in one state it's voters saying, look, let's put minimum wage on the ballot. In another state it might be reviving local media. And it feels like there needs to be some thought as to if popular interests are to be reflected in policy, there needs to be some strategy here.
I think that's right. And I know this is not what you mentioned, but since you mentioned your work on gerrymandering, I just want to add that, you know, in the work that I've seen, the extent of gerrymandering, which is even more extreme in state legislatures than it is in the U.S. Congress, has an impact not just on who gets elected, but how controllable they are while they're in office. There are a number of cases where there were moderate Republicans who were threatened. For instance, when Right to Work, an anti-union law in Michigan, was passed, the Senate Majority Leader, who is a moderate pro-labor Republican, was opposed to it and was taken into a small room with some big money donors and told, basically, either you support this or this is going to be your last term in office because we'll pull our money from you and give it to an opponent in the primary.
Yeah, get primary.
So because so few state legislative districts are competitive in the sense that they could go either Republican or Democrat, the threat to pull money for a primary is much more powerful than it would be if we didn't have the extent of gerrymandering, which means those politicians are under more control even while they're in office by moneyed interests because of that.
Yeah, if you look at in one gerrymandering case that's before the Supreme Court right now, one of the arguments is that voters' power is removed except for the primary. And so, for instance, in a state that's, in that case, reliably Democratic, that the Democrats stole from the Republicans, it's on the other side of the aisle from what we're talking about today. That's a case where if you're a Republican, you have no way to influence the outcome. You have to vote in the primary. But over and over again in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, all these are states where what you are describing in Michigan is replicated over and over again with representatives who must face their base. And if 40% of their base is angry and malleable, then that's reactor fuel that's just not in the reactor vessel. It's everywhere and it's ready to dirty everything.
No comment on that one. Wow. I think, sorry. I think Sam just stunned you with that bleak remark. Maybe we can end. Okay. So we have now unpacked the problem and unpacked the consequences. And you've talked a little bit about areas where there are ways to go in a different direction. What has to happen in the next few years to change this direction in American politics, to at least constrain some of the influence corporations are having? What practically can be done realistically so that, say, in 2020, we're not looking at the exact same kind of political landscape?
Well, one thing I would say is I understand why people are bored by state politics, but if there was just one moment that people would wake up and pay attention, it should be the 2020 elections, because that is the next set of state legislators who are going to redraw the district lines, both for the Congress and the state legislatures. And part of the reason that we've had the wave of legislation that we have had in the past decade is that within two months, I think, of the Citizens United decision in early 2010, the Chamber of Commerce and other corporate interests got together with some Republican strategists and created a new vehicle for raising a lot of corporate money whose goal was to take over state legislatures in the fall of 2010 because they knew those people were going to redraw the district boundaries. And they flipped 11 states that had previously been either Democratic-controlled or mixed Democratic-Republican to be wall-to-wall Republican. So that's part of the legacy that we're living with. And I think the importance of 2020 is something that everybody, and most importantly, the organizations that have resources and can turn out organizers or their base, need to focus energy on. And then the other, you know, I don't have a grandmaster plan for reversing this, but the other hopeful thing that I've seen is ballot initiatives, or in times when organizations are able to convert candidate races into issue races by saying, not we're supporting so-and-so for the Board of Education because they're nice, because we like them, but we'll support everybody who supports the following two things or three things, or somehow try to convert those races into issue races, because that's where there's much broader bipartisan support for creating a fairer economy.
Well, we are actually out of time. That was a really fascinating conversation, and we both want to thank you, Gordon Lafer, for speaking with us. Again, Gordon is at the University of Oregon Labor Education Research Center. He's a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute. And his new book is The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time, which Cornell University Press has published. And we urge you to get a copy and take a look. Thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, that wraps up our episode. Once again, you can now find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify.
We're everywhere.
We're everywhere. So thanks for joining us. We'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.